Now that we have an expectant hush, let me welcome you to the 8th annual Ernest Gellner Nationalism Lecture on behalf of Nations and Nationalism. I'm John Hutchinson, and this lecture, as you know, was established to honor the memory and intellectual contribution of Professor Ernest Gellner to the study of nationalism. It's our pleasure to have as our 8th speaker Professor George Shoflin, Jean Monnet Professor of Politics at the University College London and the School of Slavonic and Eastern European Studies, who's had many years association with Professor Gellner. Professor Gellner's theories, of course, perhaps were inspired and have got a very strong resonance with the situation of Central and Eastern Europe, and so it's particularly suitable that we have Professor Shoflin tonight, one of the leading experts in this area. Professor Shoflin has been associated with ASEAN and Nations and Nationalism from its very primordial beginnings, a full 10 years ago, I think. And his latest book, Nations, Identity and Power, was published in 2000. It has a most splendid cover, which I recommend you examine. And he's written very widely on various aspects of identity, politics in Central and Southeastern Europe. I think he claims to be Hungarian, but he's really a Scot. At least he's as Scottish as Mel Gibson, but he brings a perspective drawn from many different backgrounds to bear on this subject, which is identity, identities, politics, and post-communism in Central Europe. Thank you.
May I have my text?
Oh, sorry. Sure, you know it.
There's a brief flurry of panic there. Well, thank you very much, John. Thank you for this introduction, and indeed thank you for inviting me in the first place. Despite this complex identity that John introduced me as having, I will be speaking in English. At least I think the language I'm speaking is English. If it's not, wave, and I'll try another language. Now, it has become customary on these occasions, with Ernest Gellner lectures, to say a few things about Ernest as a person. And not only do I not want to deviate from this custom, but actually I do want to say something about Ernest as a Central European. Now, I was never a student of Ernest's, but I came to know him reasonably well as a colleague. One of my very first academic experiences was to undertake a joint supervision with Ernest on a Czech topic of which he knew far more than I did. It was a humbling experience. And then I was privileged to hear Ernest's last public lecture in Budapest on the day before he died. I recall very well he'd been most reluctant to speak at all and then spoke off the cuff for half an hour, cogently and clearly as ever. It was only after Ernest's untimely death that I began to appreciate what the Central European side of his personality meant, and for what it's worth, stimulated me to try and define my own Central Europeanness. Now, of course, there were differences. There was a difference in generations. He, of course, was an adult during the war. I was a child. Clearly, that marked things in both of us. Then I think there are very real differences between the Czech and Hungarian identities, although I think there are, and I certainly see them, shared qualities as well. I saw in particular how Ernest's sense of humor and irony were not unlike the way in which I understood the cultural norms in which I lived, and equally, how many people did not understand them and disliked them, though generally they were too polite to say so. There is something specific about Central European irony, which I would like to suggest grows directly out of what will be one of the main themes of this lecture, the particularities of Central Europe and its view of the world. I believe that Central European irony was and is a response to one of the less appealing features of Central European discourse, its vulnerability to self-pity, to a sense of fatalism, a weakness of agency. The standard response, which is, I think, a central facet of the national self in the region, is a kind of intense, emotionally charged articulation of nationhood, an overwhelming sense of belonging, which saps one's critical faculties, makes one weak towards one's faults as a nation, and hypersensitive towards real or often as not perceived injuries. This emotionalism functions as an extraordinarily powerful cognitive closure, a screening out. One cannot and will not see anything other than what the national self tells us to see. Now, to an extent, all collectivities do this. They all screen out aspects of the world that jar, that do not conform. Now, for any self-respecting intellectual, and as we know, Central Europe is the truest home of intellectuals, this is intolerable because it is threatening. It threatens autonomy. It threatens real and hoped-for detachment from whatever intellectuals are investigating. It hardly needs saying that strong emotion shuts out reason. There are, I would suggest, two responses, and both of them were central to Ernest's strategies. They are irony and rationality. So Ernest's sense of humor, which so many found disturbing, was, I believe, transferred from its natural Central European habitat to Britain and British academic life. It made his style wholly memorable. I can still remember Ernest giving an early account of his theory of nationalism at a seminar here, I think it was in 1981. Now, during the question, somebody made the point that if industrialization was the motor of national mobilization, then how come that pre-industrial nations could come into being? I'm vulnerable to that, he replied with a wry smile. His insistence on rationality at the same time became his lodestar, his overriding answer to a troubled and troubling world. I further believe that the continued role of identity as a source of reasoning, of particular identities, remained one of his enduring concerns. His response to this concern illuminates much of his later work, which I don't feel I have to list here. All this raises the question, what exactly is an identity? How is it to be understood? How identities are constructed and why? And this is the next topic to which I want to turn. I am, of course, dealing here with collective identities, and I would like to stress that we all have both individual and collective identities, that we are all members of many collective identity groups, and that individual and collective identities are in some form of reciprocal potentiation. My second methodological assumption is that identities, in common with all human activities, are constructed. Indeed, what I would call Durkheim's dilemma is a guiding thought. If we human beings make our world, then how come that we are compelled by what we make? It is to this dilemma that I'd like to devote some thought, because some of the answers that trouble us today at the level of practical politics as well as nationalism theory can be discerned there. In particular, there's a very powerful line of thought with the potency of an axiology that the legacy of Enlightenment rationality has the cogency to make us all universalists. Indeed, in some thinkers, the duty to accept universal values. I think it is this assumption that lies at the heart of what might be called simple identity construction, not least in the work of Hobsbawm and Anderson, both of whom imply that if particular identities are constructed, then they can just as readily be deconstructed. The axiology of both Hobsbawm and Anderson is focused, at least indirectly, on this target. Now, the problem then arises, if identities can be so readily unmasked, why do they persist? Is it that people are really stupid, people that cannot hear the falconer, that they prefer to listen to false prophets? Now, you will recognize this trope, not least from the numerous student essays that I've had to read, the argument of which turns on the proposition of elite manipulation. Are people who, you will remember, are meant to be rational, really so malleable, so ready to sell the rationalist birthright for a mess of nationalist pottage? Or is it that nationalist elites are super cunning, a bit like Lenin's crafty bourgeois, who was always more clever than the honest proletarian. Now, I don't believe these explanations for one second. I would like to suggest instead that identity, far from being irrational, offers a rationality of its own, and indeed that neither a universalistic nor a particularistic perspective satisfactorily resolves these problems. Rather, the two have to be examined together, acting upon one another reciprocally. The starting point is that as human beings, our own knowledge of the world, our vision, is invariably and necessarily partial and particular. Cognitive processes screen out much of the ideas and information that we receive, otherwise we would suffer overload. This means that we repeatedly encounter phenomena to which we do not have answers, but to which we respond conventionally. Convention, of course, implies that some form of collective knowledge has come into being, and that we rely on it to make sense of the world. Sense-making inevitably requires us to simplify, to construct stereotypes, to cut out a great deal of information as superfluous, to take things for granted. The expert systems on which we rely so much are a typical case in point. We do not feel impelled to reinvent the internal combustion engine every time we sit in a car. We just assume that it will work. Usually it does. That is a fairly universal and a concrete example. But most of what we regard as common sense is structurally identical, though rather more particularistic. English common sense reflects the particular assumptions of the English, and French common sense, if I can use such a strongly Anglo-Saxon term, is quite different. The question then is how these conventional forms of knowledge come into being, and how they shape our sense of self. What effect do they have on our encounters with others who understand the world from a wholly different set of assumptions, whose forms of collective knowledge do not resemble ours at all? Clearly, even at the most elementary level, we encounter a communication problem, one that becomes more and more complex the deeper we delve into the world of otherness. At the same time, through our encounter with otherness, our own sense of self, our own identity, is reinforced. Identity is necessarily relational, so that contact with otherness is both positive and negative. And this, incidentally, makes the invention of this neologistic verb to other something or someone rather pointless. The upshot of the argument so far is that collectivities have both an inward and an outward dimension. The inward dimension is what gives an identity group its cohesion, its outwardness, its sense of particularity. Now, this inward dimension is not, of course, total. There are always external influences that impact on a collectivity, and it is the task of the inward processes to secure cohesion on an ongoing basis. This proposition raises two questions. One is, what exactly is it that has come into being? What is a collectivity, as I've termed it? And second, what is it for? Why have collectivities, and why have the identities that are constructed by them? These questions are necessarily interdependent. The answer to the first question, what a collectivity is best approached by regarding it as a form of shared human activity, a set of processes that people are engaged in, and as a form of human action that can be interpreted, understood, and read. As such, it is perfectly possible to read identities as a text. Now, anything can be a text in this sense. Language, of course, a social process, a ritual, a building, a crowd, whatever you like. And in a collectivity as text, as a set of complex, interactive communications, the exchanges that take place do so in a set framework, which we can properly call a field, and the content of these exchanges can be said to constitute a form of discourse. So we can see that in this form it becomes methodologically feasible to interpret identity construction and to take the next step to try and understand what purpose an identity collective serves. So to understand this proposition, we have to go back to something that I argued earlier, to world-making and sense-making. The world and the inputs that we receive are infinite. And in order to make sense of these informational inputs, we have to reduce them to comprehensibility. But for communication to be effective, the individuals engaged in communicating must have a set of shared meanings, a conventionally determined set of collective criteria for decoding the world. Collective identities are at the center of this activity. The criteria by which we understand the world are particular, are specific to one group rather than another. They differ amongst themselves, and they are reproduced over time. Otherwise, there would be chaos. And if there's one phenomenon which human collectivities detest, it is chaos. The inconsistencies of understandings and meanings with which we collide when disorder strikes. This is deeply troubling. Indeed, it triggers off the deepest fears and crises of human life, including manifestly much of what we encounter in the world today. So, what I want to say is that collectivities engage in a range of activities to ensure that this crisis of meanings does not take place. They construct narratives about themselves. These attribute vice and virtue. They define the ground rules of good and evil, clearly particularistic, which regulate the ethical norms of that particular collectivity. They try to sustain these norms by encoding them in such a form as to make them as difficult as possible to decode and question. To attain this, they use a kind of collective shorthand, like myth. A myth is a narrative of self, a symbol, charging objects and events with particular significance. Ritual, collective action that can generate solidarity without consensus. Now, these are all collective texts that can be read and understood. This doesn't mean this is an easy activity, but it can be done. Collective texts, in effect, condense meaning. They function as agreed criteria by which the collectivity conducts its affairs. These collective texts can be called a thought world. And I think it follows from what I've been saying that collectivities are engaged in producing collective norms. They are identity collectives of moral value creation, and in that sense, they seek recognition as moral communities. Furthermore, this is a much contested area, collectivities erect boundaries to demarcate themselves from other collectivities. There's a lot of stuff about boundaries around. Now, much has been written and said about the permeability of boundaries. Some even go so far as to argue that as a concept, boundaries are meaningless. It is the ability to cross boundaries that is important. Maybe so. But boundaries have to be understood if we're also to recognize how they may be crossed. Transgressivity is only viable if there is actually something to transgress. You might say this is common sense, but I'm not sure I dare to use that term. Boundary mechanisms have a further purpose. They regulate the traffic. They filter out certain ideas and the qualities of received information. They secure the consistency of the collective identity, and no amount of deconstruction will change this. Now, anything can be a boundary mechanism, from dress code to dietary code. But I think the single most important such mechanism is language, which I'd like now to say a little bit about. I think that language as a concept is much misunderstood because it exists at three separate interconnected levels. And it should be understood, should bear it in mind, these three levels, when we try to analyze what language is. Now, there is the first, most obvious level, the philological level. This tells us that English is a particular language, French is another particular language, Hungarian is yet another. Now, without studying them, there is no automatic communication between them. Level one. Level two is the cultural level. Here, I think, specific meanings evolve, attached to local particularities, and they give philological language a denser, more concentrated set of meanings. All languages at this level also become repositories of collective memory, of psychological complexity, of nuance, and of diversity. At this level, we can see that British English and American are philologically the same language, but there are many situations in which they're culturally different, with different sense being given to different bits of information, vocabulary, not to mention accent and register, and in this instance, contextuality. Notoriously, British English is a very high context language. A meaning is conveyed by the context, not by the words. It's conveyed by phrasing, by omission, by body language, tone, facial expression, and so on. All the features that make British English impossible for non-Brits to understand. The third level is political. When a language comes to be used as a language of political power, for articulating power, it will necessarily acquire the qualities associated with that power. It will develop in various ways, like accumulate a political, administrative, and military vocabulary. More significantly, the holders of power will use that language for legitimation. And crucially, they will try to establish, as far as they possibly can, a monological set of meanings, maximally unambiguous and unchallengeable as a language, in which truth claims acquire the sense of being the sole truth, the natural way of being. We talk about naturalizing meanings. At both the cultural and the political levels, language comes to acquire a symbolic identity-marking quality. When those who use it feel that it is under threat, they feel it's their identity that is under threat, they will try to defend it. For example, by purism. Some languages exclude loan words. It's a way of marking yourself out from others. Elites, and sometimes elites with non-elites, will construct new vocabularies. The way in which different languages have coped with the internet is one illustration. Every language in the world, I think, has its own word, which English doesn't, for the at sign. It's mostly to do with snails and cats and animals of one kind or another. But English just calls it at, but because there was no English word for it, different languages developed their own word for it. Let me give you one other illustration of language development. 16th century English was regarded as no longer effective in trying to express the full range of meaning that its practitioners wanted to express. Hence, the extraordinary accumulation of new words at that time. Shakespeare was only one innovator among many. Quite a few of the words that he made up are now totally unintelligible to us without a glossary. But the unbelievable inventiveness of that period, using mostly Latin and Greek originals, is quite astonishing. Which, of course, does mean that 16th century English is very similar to the position, which I will come to presently, of language renewal in Central Europe, which just happens to be in the 19th and 20th centuries. Once the process of transforming a cultural language into a political language has been launched, the relationship between language and political identity becomes reciprocal. The language is used by that particular collectivity as a part of its identity, and it will differentiate it from others. The ideas, the forms of knowledge that are so expressed will further strengthen the collective self. The arrival of the new, whether it's material or non-material, will then demand adjustment, and thereby cultural reproduction becomes an ongoing process. Now, everything that I've just said, all the foregoing, is to be understood as the preliminary argument about the rise of nationhood. I am going to talk about nations and nationalism. It's only appropriate. The definition of nationhood that I'm adopting, and I want to stress this, does to some degree determine which aspects of the theory of nationalism we put in the foreground. For my purposes, the nation is above all a political category, a particular way of structuring the relationship between rulers and ruled. This does not mean that nations do not have cultural, sociological, anthropological, or other dimensions. They certainly have a gastronomical dimension. They do, but I would argue that without understanding the political dimension, too much is lost. If nationhood is about anything, it is about political power, and it is from the perspective of political power that I want to proceed. Not least the category nation, rather better the Latin natio, had a political significance in pre-modernity. It referred to those with a right of access to politics and political power in a particular realm. The aristocracy, the higher clergy, certain burgesses, with a monarch above them all. So nations did indeed exist in the Middle Ages, but their content and quality were quite different from what we regard as nations today. I don't think that it needs any serious argument to clarify this proposition. The political arrangements to deal with 3 to 4% of the population will be wholly different from the needs of a political system that notionally includes the entire population of a given territory. The question is, how did we get here from there? And this, I think, has been one of the central questions raised by the great debate on nationalism of the last 2 or 3 decades, the one to which Gellner and many others contributed. And I will offer a further proposition here. I will take it as common ground that we all accept that there is such a thing as modernity. I know that some people disagree about precisely what constitutes modernity. To my mind, modernity can be identified because something changed in Europe in or around the 18th century. For Gellner, the change, and this was a radical change that precipitated more changes, was the coming of industrialism. I would like to argue something different. Something did change, but it was not the industrial mode of production that was central. Rather, from the 16th century on, 17th century, we can argue about the exact date, the state, the political ruler, acquired an enormously increased capacity to condense power. A variety of factors combined to produce this change. In the first instance, I would like to mention the vastly increased information storage capacity, to use very contemporary vocabulary, generated by printing. Anderson, you will all recall, writes of print capitalism. I would like to suggest that as a motor of change, print editism was far more significant. For the first time, the ruler had the capacity to expand and intensify record keeping and thereby make his or her subject legible. If you put somebody on a register, you make them legible. This development had far-reaching implications for a whole range of other activities, military planning, state organization, all the rationalization that we associate with a modern administrative system. Crucially, and I think this is absolutely at the center of it, it permitted the ruler to extend the power of the state over taxation and coercion. That actually is where we come into modern democratic theory. The exercise of power should be understood as having a reciprocal relationship at its heart. Whether that reciprocal relationship is formally agreed as it is in democracy or not, a ruler cannot ignore his or her subjects. Power, as a rule, is much more effective if it is actually exercised consensually. If the people who are taxed and coerced accept this as a part of the natural order, naturalized as a part of their identity. The people over whom the newly enhanced power of the state was to be exercised were no longer the ones who readily accepted the medieval order of secular and religious hierarchy, feudalism and universal Catholicism. The Reformation and secularization made inroads into the authority of the church, and non-feudal forms of power relationships showed that alternative models were possible. Crucially, the print revolution also affected society in a number of ways. Literacy was no longer the preserve of maybe 2, 3, 4% of the population, but was spreading. And here I think the insistence of Protestantism on script literacy was vital. The intellectual explosion through the ready availability of information rippled through society. I don't know if any of you have read Jonathan Israel's book on the Enlightenment. It's absolutely fascinating. It's a spellbinding book. That's the footnote that I'm putting here. So this new information rippling through society, simultaneously economic growth provided a rising number of people with a material security that only a very few had enjoyed before. The outcome was a legitimation crisis by the 18th century. Now, the Republic of Letters that launched the Enlightenment offered the world 3 heady propositions, intoxicating, if you like. These were emancipation, freedom. Second, the speculative unity of all knowledge. It's the Hegelian moment. And thirdly, the unification of all into a single, transcendental, universal identity of reason. The French Revolution was the culmination of the project of emancipation, and it has been with us ever since. Both unity of knowledge and the universality of reason continue to inform, to structure how we see the world today. But if the protagonists of universalistic thought, the protagonists of universalism, thought that they could replace the decaying political structures of neo-feudalism and religious order only by arguing from reason, it seems to me they were mistaken. And I think they were mistaken for a number of reasons, possibly the most cogent of which was the assumption that there was only one single way of understanding universal reason. The response to the truth claim of a single universal set of norms was a mixture of anxiety, of marginality, reaction. We can see this, Isaiah Berlin has written about this, in the relationship between the impact of France, the French Enlightenment, and Germany. Isaiah Berlin has written about this at great length. But we find this in other marginal society, marginal to the core, which we'll come to presently. It seems to me that the universalists had overstated their position. They believed that their epistemology was valid for the whole world, whereas in reality it reflected the contingent power, the political, economic, intellectual, but contingent power of Western Europe, primarily France, England, the Netherlands. In effect, the rapid development of intellectual capital in these communities had the unintended consequence of producing uneven intellectual development. Now, Gellner himself used uneven development in its material dimension, in its sociological dimension, as an explanatory factor for the spread of nationalism. I think there's every benefit to be had from extending it to intellectuality as well. This exposition, brief exposition, of the intellectual order of the 18th century, which I've just offered you, in order to allow us to look at the evolution of nationhood, will allow us to look at the political dimension of developments. Now, the legitimation crisis of the old order, which I mentioned, the erosion of feudalism and of religion, together with the growing power of the state, and the rising demand for access to power on the part of a range of people far wider than the members of the medieval nation, the Latinatio, came together to produce two outcomes. One of these was the pressing need to find a mode of consent to be ruled by new means, one that would modify the old but not threaten the beneficiaries of the old order too much, to preserve, if you like, a dignified degree of continuity. And the other was to invent a political form, a new structure of governance with its own legitimating discourses that would permit a far-reaching distribution and actually continuing redistribution of power. Now, no one is going to give away political power unless they have to. But they can be persuaded or forced to do so. By persuading, I mean reform. By being forced to, I mean revolution. And Europe has been the scene of both. What the 18th century saw was both. The discourses to legitimate the distribution of power were in place by 1789, and the fact that the French Revolution took a coercive turn did nothing to alter that. I think it slowed things down. Probably the Reform Act of 1832 in this country would have been passed rather earlier. But you know, when you see the aristocracy and the representatives of the old order being guillotined en masse, you become rather reluctant to redistribute power. I can't say I entirely blame people. Nobody wants to hang from the nearest lamppost. So when you have revolutionaries shouting to the lampposts, then people in other countries will say, maybe revolution is not such a bright idea. Now, what I want to say here is that the discourse of nationhood, in essence, and we have seen that this has been the discursive field employed to legitimate access to power, was redefined in such a way as to make access to power open to all the inhabitants of a territory, thereby eventually converting them from subjects to citizens, if everything went well. They could all be defined as members of the nation. Now, this left open one further problem. One did not affect the pioneers in the short term, but has come to haunt the latecomers, including the Central Europeans, to whom I will presently turn. Who is to be a member of the nation? How is the identity, whether it's a directly political identity or a non-political identity, constructed around nationhood, to be defined? If cultural norms are to play a role in access to political power, then how are these to be determined? What of the myth-symbol complex? What of the boundary mechanisms? And quite apart from anything else, how are the latecomers supposed to do it? How are they to act? Are they free to define their nations? Lacking their own access to political power, how should they act? In fact, we know this, the pioneers didn't really care, at least not in the first instance. They used the raw materials to hand and condensed cultural power together with the political power. But of course, matters were nothing like as straightforward for the latecomers. They found themselves in a set of dilemmas and had to struggle to establish their claims. To some degree, this is still the case. The very success of political and cultural modernity as embodied in the nation, and here the Napoleonic Wars are a very clear illustration, became both a threat and an opportunity for the latecomers. It was threatening because the unevenness of power directly affected their capacity for cultural reproduction. Look at the partitions of Poland. The terms on which they were allowed to exist were transformed, the latecomers, without any serious input from them. The Napoleonic years, let us say, were certainly a threat to Britain, but how much more of a threat were they to Central Europe, where Napoleonic armies marched without so much as by your leave, and where the ruling empires, Congress of Vienna, swapped territories as if they were stamps. So let me move on to the last part of this analysis, and that's Central Europe. If we look at the trajectory of Central Europe, we find a pattern that is wholly different from the one with which we are familiar in the West. From the 16th century onwards, the region has been the scene of a series of attempted transformations, modernizations, if you like. They are brought in from the outside. They may have local champions, but the underlying ideas of which are developed elsewhere and in response to the needs of elsewhere. Now, it is this semi-subordinate and wholly subordinate relationship to external power, cultural power obviously included, as well as political, that can be said to characterize the region and to generate the responses that are variously described as indeterminacy, incompleteness, hybridity, coupled with the dependency and the self-pity that I mentioned right at the outset. Trying to define and redefine oneself in the face of a much stronger external power from a position of weakness is never an exalting experience. So, in chronological order, the first of these external transformations was the Counter-Reformation, or I think more properly, the Catholic Reformation. It introduced a new set of discourses, a new concept of order, and did so in competition, in continuous competition, with Protestantism. It is important to recognize that while Catholicism had the upper hand in most of Central Europe, it seldom had a free hand. The Catholic Reformation was never fully consensual. It was imposed. Protestant modes lived on and informed attitudes in a variety of ways, sometimes overtly, sometimes underground. The values of the Counter-Reformation were an emphasis on hierarchy and obedience, on visuality rather than literacy, on community rather than individuality or individualism, on the value of wholeness rather than the accuracy of detail. If I were visually minded here, I would show you an illustration of a Baroque altar. It attempts to encompass the world. The detail is all there, but actually it's not the detail that matters, it's the wholeness of it. Very different from Protestant modes. Protestant modes are a counterpoint to this, and Protestantism has been a seedbed of resistance, of determination to resist, even of obstinacy. Counter-Reformation thinking has had one further legacy of major significance in Central Europe. It prefers to look at structures rather than discrete events, discrete facts, and to identify structures wherever possible in decoding the world. Now, this can result in very cogent insights, but it also weakens agency. It makes individual action appear futile in the face of insurmountable structural obstacles. I've spent a bit of time on this Catholic-Protestant polarity, because I think it constitutes a good part of the cultural capital with which the region confronted modernity, and therefore the cognitive models with which the region sought to define its own models of modernity. The Counter-Reformation style, the Baroque, remains in being and is clearly recognizable as a key element in the Central European thought style. Again, in illustration, you cannot understand Prague, you cannot really like Prague, if you don't like the Baroque. Same, I think, is true of Warsaw, of Krakow. Budapest is a kind of late Baroque, and there are other. Vilnius is an absolutely wonderful gem, Baroque city. You can't understand without actually responding to it. You can just dismiss it as clutter. This is an error, it means you're not understanding. But you know, I know people who do this. And they only go to Prague for the beer, but the beer is also good. Now, the next attempt at transformation was the imperial one, the attempt by the absolutist state to construct a high-capacity state that could compete with the centers of power emerging in the West, crucially intensifying taxing and coercion. If any of you have read McCartney's History of the Habsburg Monarchy, you will see that a continuously re-emerging trope is the imperial treasury in Vienna never has enough money. Plus ça change, you may say. Now, this project of increasing state capacity was fairly typical of modernizations from above. It took what it liked from the external model, the Western model, core model, and omitted the bits it didn't like. In this instance, the proposition that power to be effective should be exercised consensually. After all, who has ever heard of a consensual empire anyway? The idea is absurd. What these transformations produced were new hybrids. They instilled a sense of fear in the sub-elites of the region that they would be leveled down by the imperial centers. The model was already there with the partitions of Poland, which I mentioned. In order to survive, the sub-elites had to find means to resist the imperial project, and they did so by devising an anti-hybrid. They took up the discourse of nationalism and married it to their own neo-feudal privileges, which were the basis of their power vis-à-vis the empires. It's a bizarre, complicated, and fairly typically Central European situation. Because they were in a weak position to condense political power on this basis, they employed what they could, cultural power, which became the basis of the ethnic definition of nationhood. It was a logical step in the circumstances. It had far-reaching and, of course, unintended consequences. It brought into being the ethnic path dependence that still marks these political communities. Now, this is not a history lecture, so I'm not going to dwell on the details of what followed. But in sum, the Central Europeans spent the 19th century, you know, of course, the 19th century ended in 1918, struggling against the empires and against one another in order to define and construct their own viable models of modernity. They took the idea of nationhood as a basic template, thereby yet again relying on the West for their impulse. The problem was, as ever, that what might have been appropriate in the West functioned differently elsewhere. Life is elsewhere, as Kundera has very correctly written. The outcome of the process of constructing nations was eventually successful in procuring statehood, but it had other, less desirable consequences too. Constructing models of modernity that were viable and recognizable was no easy task. The empires, the losers from the process, were not going to give in easily, and this fed the Central European sense of frustration and resentment. I think the problem was this. To gain recognition of one's existence now had a new old criterion, political power. Political power, of course, as a concept had changed. Whereas before the coming of modernity, political power was, as we have seen, linked to the medieval natio, The contours and content of modern nationhood were different. The new dispensation, the one brought into being by the Congress of Vienna in 1815, was contradictory. It gave already recognized political entities further recognition, but unrecognized entities couldn't claim the status of being nations and could therefore be subjected to the modernizing attempts of the empires, and these threatened them with absorption. So the new order in effect prompted the Central Europeans to shake off imperial rule by whatever means were to hand. And note, of course, this is already happening in southeastern Europe. The Serbian uprising of 1806, and then very importantly as a role model, the Greeks do this in the 1820s. Somehow, you see, the Ottoman Empire was just a little less equal than the Austrian and Prussian and Russian. This lesson, I think, was not lost on the Central Europeans. They had to define their nations with a political dimension in order to extract political autonomy from the imperial ruler, which the imperial ruler was not going to give away. So what we can see here is the collision of discourses, an imperial discourse and a national discourse, or a discourse of nationhood. In the long term, nations were invariably more successful in generating consent and greater dynamism, so that time was on their side, but it often didn't seem so to contemporaries. The inertial forces of empire, I'm thinking here, for example, of Kaiser Troyer, loyal to the empire, it's right there up to 1918 in Austria-Hungary. There are Austro-Hungarian regiments which continue in their loyalty to the bitter end. Not all, but some. Together with, extremely importantly, the size of the pre-political population, the peasantry. This worked to delay the coming of independence. So the collision of empire and nationhood, in effect, inhibited the capacity to democratize these populations and the political communities that they were to construct. But the threatened local elites, the sub-elites as I've called them, Polish aristocracy, Hungarian, the Czech bourgeoisie, I'm uneasy with this term, the Romanian, Croatian aristocracies, gentry, I think they had no choice. They might start from aristocratic privilege as their source of power, but they understood that they had to modernize it if they were to survive. And modernization necessarily meant adopting and adapting the intoxicating ideas of the French Revolution, access to political power on the part of all, in spite, of course, of this undermining their own position. And I think this adaptation is the key. The local elites had pre-modern political power and sought to modernize it by making it national power. Nationhood, given the power of the empires to inhibit political autonomy, had only one place to go, and that was culture. These elites then had to rely on the definition of a culture as the source of power, and that meant mobilizing constituencies to support that power. So membership of a culturally defined nation was the Central European answer to the challenge of the French Revolution. The length of the struggle ensured that these local elites, which of course changed in composition as the century wore on, were able to spread their message into the core of the potential nation. There were always problems at the periphery. Furthermore, the relationship between cultural power and political power became inextricable. So the argument fashionable today that seeks to decouple political power from culture, culture as ethnic mobilization, and to make political power the exclusive attribute of citizenship is unlikely to be effective, certainly in the short term. Political power and ethnic identity cannot be decoupled, given that the state, source of political power, will always have a role in cultural reproduction, making control of the state a key target of political action. It's a circular force. So the movement for nationhood as the political guarantor of cultural reproduction did not stop with the collectivities that already had their own political discourses, the ones I mentioned, Czechs, Poles, and Hungarians in the first instance. And it had some degree of political power, however limited. It spread to other groups, which were able to define themselves without the resource of political discourses. They had to construct it from nothing. In this instance, the movement was exclusively cultural, relying overwhelmingly on language. I'm thinking here of the Slovenes, the Slovaks, Latvians, Estonians, and actually one or two that fail to take off. For example, the Kashubs, they don't make it for contingent reasons. By the end of the First World War, they were able to demand and gain recognition, sometimes in state form, sometimes not. Sometimes they had to wait till the 1990s. Self-definition in cultural terms, however, was always contingent. The particular circumstances of history, the configuration of power, geographic factors, the nature of the elite with which they had to contend, all these could be relevant in the emergence of new nations. Now, 1918, Paris Peace Settlement, etc., followed the First World War. State independence became a reality for Central Europe, even while, of course, it had also come into being somewhat earlier in Southeastern Europe. In the sense of preserving cultural reproduction, of creating a space within which cultural reproduction could be preserved, independence was a success. Unfortunately, in respect of creating space for consent, for democracy and citizenship, of taking up the other message of the French Revolution, was something of a failure. State national independence does not inherently produce democracy or stability. Maybe a step in the right direction. So the problem for the Central Europeans was that their models of modernity were incomplete. Their models of completeness were unattainable, and their models of nationhood were predicated on a degree of cultural homogeneity that were irreconcilable with democracy. Above all, the lure of the Jacobin model of centralization of the state and of cultural power was taken to be the Western standard. In this connection, too, irony breaks in. Just as the empires failed to understand that without consent, the state could only condense limited amounts of power, so the newly independent Central European states did likewise. Just don't learn from experience, do we? They sought to condense cultural and political power and neglected the consensual civic side of the equation. The outcome was something close to state failure, helped from time to time by interventions of the great powers, Munich being clearly a case in point. Attack on Poland in 1939 from two sides was another. 1941 Yugoslavia, not a few such helpful interventions. Now, in each case, the Polish, the Czech, and Hungarian elites discovered that as latecomers to modernity, the models taken over from the West did not produce the intended outcomes, but generated resistance from other national collectivities and from sections of their own society. The experiment was a failure. This had its own consequences. After 1945, in terms of a rejection of the past and to some extent a rejection of the West, this was quite explicit in the case of the Czechs. The Beneš decrees, which are at the moment sort of on the agenda, although everyone is saying is not, are at any rate in part about this, the terrible failure of Munich. Simultaneously, this produced, what shall I call it, a vulnerability to the seductiveness of a communist alternative. Now, I haven't time to deal with communism, that's another set of lectures, but let me just say here, we all know this, communism was yet another externally imposed modernization and another failure. I can't go into the reasons of why, though I think there is a reason for all these failures, and it is one with a relevance, a direct relevance to the post-1989 period. Without a domestic model of modernity, or at any rate a sense of being a modern nation, the externally derived aspects of modernity will invariably grate against the domestic tradition, against the grain of cultural expectations and aspirations. The difficulty for the Central Europeans is that while they need the requisite degree of condensed cultural power to produce adequate state administrative capacity, for example, to generate a uniform distribution of authority, which I think they have, the elites lacked the confidence in the population that they were sufficiently united culturally to allow more redistribution of power. It's a terrible dilemma. The road to citizenship and democracy was blocked. Can the democratic systems introduced after 1989 break this vicious cycle? Well, I think I'm an optimist. The answer is yes. But as ever, there are problems. the political and cultural thought styles of Central Europe are out of alignment with those of the West. Very roughly, the contrast is between the moralizing and historicizing approach of the Central Europeans as against the emphasis on procedure and pragmatics of the West. The mere reception of democratic institutions is not in itself a guarantee of a democratic way of doing things. What the West has done in the last decade or more, especially when European Union membership came on the agenda, has been to insist on the Central Europeans reaching a given set of norms, the Copenhagen criteria, in brief. This conditionality has simply been imposed. There has been no serious attempt to debate the principles of European democracy. The negotiations for membership of the European Union have been largely technocratic and have not produced the kind of normative debate that would encourage populations to internalize the values that the West places in the foreground. The outcome has been paradoxical. The closer a post-communist state gets to actual membership of the EU, the lower the enthusiasm for joining. The West has not been prepared to engage with a symbolic and historicist dimension of European enlargement, so vital to the Central European sense of self-esteem, with the result that Europeanness is remote, it's abstract, it's symbolic. In effect, the European Union, by adopting the negotiating style that it did, has unwittingly exported its own democratic deficit eastwards. Yet another irony. The worst case scenario may well be to reproduce that sense of incompleteness, the hybridity, the indeterminacy that have haunted Central Europe for centuries. Their own thought styles and thought worlds, while specific to them, are seen as a nuisance and as backward in the West, and they are effectively denied the chance of constructing their own domestic models of modernity. This will not change, I would like to suggest, even after EU membership comes into being, at the latest by 2005, maybe even 2004, because Central Europe will have to conform to whatever the West decides. So if nothing else, the Central European way of interpreting the world, with its contradictions and paradoxes, its ironies, its dependencies, its attractive and negative features, are very likely to live on. Thank you for your attention.
George, we have time for a few questions. I'm sure it must have stimulated a great deal of thought. Yes.
Yes. This lecture was focused on Central Europe, so I haven't really gone into... you will have noticed I carefully avoided trying to define Central Europe. I have done this elsewhere. But I was actually targeting another particular problem. Yes, I think that, very briefly, and perhaps even rather crudely, Central Europe, in the present constellation, is regarded as integrable in the European Union. Southeastern Europe is not, at any rate today. I think, in actually, rock-bottom pragmatics, bog-standard pragmatics, to put it in that way, there is no way that a country like Romania, regrettably, can support the acquis communautaire. It's totally pointless even to think so. Don't even contemplate the idea of Albanian membership of the European Union, for for a long time to come. I think this is regrettable, but it's a reality. Unless the European Union says we do want to include these states, another form of membership. On present terms, it's out of the question. There are very good reasons for this. I think that Southeastern Europe has had a different trajectory of development. Crucially, again, this is an oversimplification, being ruled by either Prussia or Russia or Austria really was qualitatively different from being ruled by the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman legacy in terms of receiving modernity was actually much more destructive. For all sorts of reasons, at the end of the day, I think the alien legitimation of the Ottoman Empire, which was alien to the great bulk of the population of, I think I'm allowed to call it Balkans or Southeast Europe is politically correct, non-Muslim populations found the legitimation of the Sultan totally alien. They couldn't cope with this. They had to construct other discourses, and then I can go into great detail, let's say, about the Serbian myth of Kosovo and so on. It seems to me that the long-term, the long-durée legacy of this has been such that the way in which the West defines modernity is even more difficult to introduce, to enroot, to localize in Southeastern Europe than it has been in Central Europe. Now, Eastern Europe is another problem. I'm not even too sure where it is. I have heard it argued that actually everything is Central Europe until you get to Russia. Ukraine is clearly Central Europe, possibly Armenia and Georgia. There are limits to this. If these terms have any meaning. Now, I don't really know the answer. Is Russia Eastern Europe? Some people say yes, some people say no. Yes and no, I think, is my answer. It clearly has a European dimension. Also, Russia also has a non-European dimension. I don't know what one does about states like Belarus and Moldova, if anything, at this particular time. I mean, I think these are, at this particular time, failed states. So I can't give you an answer about Eastern Europe because I don't even know where it is. Well, I don't want to be seriously unorthodox here, but I think that right-wing voting is a West European problem, not a Central or Southeast European one at this particular time. I'm not just thinking of our friend Le Pen, but if you're following what's happening in the Netherlands with Pim Fortuyn very likely to get 20% on the 15th of May, it seems to me that this is above all a West European problem. And here again, I mean, this illustrates some of what I've been arguing, that when Mr. Csurka, the great Hungarian demagogue, the only demagogue with whom I'm on first name terms, I'm not proud of this, makes these, I mean, you know, the terrible discovery for me was to discover that demagogues were younger than me. That's Milosevic. But I'm not on first name terms with him. And I don't send him text messages into The Hague. But, you know, when he makes statements, everyone panics and says fascism, Nazism, concentration camps, terrible. You know, when this happens in Protestant Holland, democratic, respectable, decent Holland, people say, oh, how very interesting, how very strange, how unfortunate. So I think there is a sense in which the West, insofar as it looks at this region, demonizes it, or at any rate finds a kind of shadow other. Look at the way in which Andrzej Leper from Poland has been treated. And I think that there is a certain propensity to exaggerate the fear, the danger of right radicalism in actually anywhere. My sense is that under normal, stable circumstances, any country, whatever it is, will produce an up to 5 to 7% vote for right radicalism. I think democratic countries can live with this. It's unpleasant, it's disagreeable, but we can live with this. It's only in extraordinary circumstances that it breaks down and then the right radicals gain more. Do they ever actually get 50%? Not really. It's rare. I think actually democracy is deeply rooted, and it is getting more deeply rooted even in Central Europe.
Gentleman over here.
Yes, well, thank you. Let me give you one further illustration of A, being Central European, and B, irony. Some of you will know that at this particular time, the foreign minister of the Czech Republic is Jan Kavan. Jan Kavan and I worked very closely together in the 1980s, various subversive activities, and it's no great secret that at that time, Jan was way, way, way out on the left. And then add a bit more to that. And I can guarantee that if in 1989 I had said to Jan, Jan, do you know that in 10 years' time you're going to be the foreign minister of a NATO country, he would have thought I was completely crazy. Yet actually, he is the foreign minister of a NATO country. That's Central Europe. Now, in answer to your question, I think there's an optimistic and a pessimistic scenario at the very least. The optimistic scenario, very crudely, is that the next vision of Europe will come from the center. Will come from Central Europe, because the Central Europeans approach Europe in a kind of grand, broad, symbolic way, and if you like, avoid the simplistic, reductionist pragmatism. I know that pragmatism isn't a very good thing in Anglo-Saxon terms, but if you're Hungarian, it's not a good thing, because you know you don't see the picture, you only see the little detail. So that's one possibility, that the Central Europeans will arrive in Brussels. Initially, Brussels will not know what to do with them. And very interestingly, what I've discovered from my researches in the last few years is that the Central Europeans who have engaged with Brussels have been extremely good in learning the technical language of the European Union. I think, given their cultural capital, they can talk their way around any office, any of the directorate generals or whatever. So that's the positive scenario, that there will be a positive contribution from Central Europe. Maybe I'm not so optimistic. Maybe there is a negative scenario, which is that these two discourses will meet and they will grate, and that the existing members of the European Union will say, oh my God, here we go again. We thought we'd solve this problem. I'm referring here to Greece, which is really regarded as an absolute disaster, should never have taken on Greece. You know, even Italy, Portugal, and Spain are suspect. These countries which never implement anything, can't we get rid of them? Now, that's sort of already there in the background. There is certainly some resistance to enlargement. It's usually coded in other ways, like the way in which the Germans and the Austrians block off their labor market, etc. So I can see the possibility that there will be a kind of strong resistance to this kind of new way of arguing it. And it's not impossible that this set of ideas, I think it comes out of number 10 Downing Street, but I'm sure it has supporters elsewhere, of setting up a three-power directorate of the United Kingdom, Germany and France. What a surprise. To run the European Union instead of the rotating presidency. Monsieur Louis Michel, the Belgian foreign minister, has already said, our experience of the EU presidency, we don't really want it anymore. Ha, ha, ha. Maybe he doesn't, but I don't think he consulted anybody else on that one. I can see an argument that, yes, it really would be difficult for any of the post-communists to run a presidency, and if Malta does join, would Malta be able to run a presidency? Well, Luxembourg did, and the population's more or less the same. But I can certainly see that one of the arguments will be that we can't allow these rubbishy little countries to run the presidency, so we must have the three-power directorate. I think it would be very dangerous. Now, I've argued this elsewhere, that one of the reasons, one of the attainments of the European project is to provide small states with recognition of status. And if that is undermined, I think there will be a revolt. And I think the Central Europeans will be involved in that revolt. And you know what happens when Central Europeans revolt. They fight forever.
Yes. Regretfully, I must bring this stimulating occasion to an end. Other events require this. Before I ask for a vote of thanks to George, can I just make the announcement that tomorrow the Association for the Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism will be holding its conference on nationalism and human rights. There's a dazzling array of speakers. It begins, I think, at about 9:45, at least 10 o'clock, I think, the official proceedings. So if you want to hear more about nationalism and its futures, please come to the LSE, the old building, at 10 o'clock tomorrow. But let me complete this occasion by asking you to thank Professor Schofflin for an extremely stimulating and synoptic lecture on Eastern and Central Europe.